This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. We know he's running for president and that he's become a household name. We also know that he ran unsuccessfully for the Republican presidential nomination in 2008, that he was governor of Massachusetts, and that he helped achieve the state's sweeping health care reform law. We know that he's Mormon, good-looking, with a great smile and perfect hair. But who is the real Romney? Who is the Mitt Romney behind the campaign debates, political ads, and handshakes? What drives him? What were the life events that shaped him and motivated him? And why does he want so much to be president? In a new book, two Boston Globe investigative reporters try to answer those questions through hundreds of interviews and years of covering Mitt Romney. Today, they join us to talk about their book titled The Real Romney. Michael Cranish and Scott Hellman will also be in New Hampshire at 6 this evening, speaking at St. Anselm College. For more information about that event, go to our website, nhpr.org. You can join us right now with your calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us at exchange at nhpr.org. You can also join us on Facebook. And Michael Cranish, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
And Scott Hellman, also thank you for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura. Thanks for having us on.
Well, and for both of you, and Michael, I think I'll start with you. On this theme of the real Romney, what did you learn, Michael, about the real Romney in the process of doing this book that your average person probably doesn't know?
Well, really, one of the things that interests us is looking at his full life. And, you know, people have said during this campaign, you know, why isn't he more open? Why does he have problems connecting? And the more I've thought about it since we finished the book and watched him on the campaign trail is that, you know, this is very much the Romney we've seen over his public career. It, things that are coming out today, questions today, really have been questions from the beginning. And clearly what you've seen is a transformation of him ideologically when he was running first for the U.S. Senate and then for governor. He was more liberal, moderate, changed positions, as people have noted, and today is running, as he calls himself, severely conservative, but he says, I wouldn't set my hair on fire. So somewhere in between there. You know, it is Romney, and so the title does not mean to say the person you saw before is not real. We are trying to give the full life story, and I think if you read the book, there's a lot of things you're seeing today that make a lot more sense, really, in the context of how he's lived his life, how he's been shaped, and the stories we tell about his family and his political career.
What about you, Scott? You covered Mitt Romney pretty closely. In doing this project with Michael, was there anything that, you know, you went, wow, I didn't know that?
There were a lot of things. I mean, that's one of the things that was remarkable about doing the book. I mean, we really, as a newspaper, of course, we've covered him for years, and yet really digging into this project, we learned a lot. I mean, just a couple of quick examples. I think one that reflects very well on Mitt Romney is I didn't realize the depth of his charitable work and how incredibly generous he and his family have been with their time over the years. And this is not just Mitt and Ann Romney writing big checks, as you would think they would do. It's also helping neighbors in small ways, stories of running into a burning house of a neighbor and leading a platoon of other neighbors to, you know, pull out couches and desks and saving what they could until the firefighters showed up.
Wow.
You know, helping to build a park in his hometown to honor the late son who had died at 12 years old of a neighbor and a friend. I mean, there are stories like this, you know, that you hear from almost everybody who knows him. And so that was, you know, I knew he had engaged in this work, but I didn't know the extent of it. And that was a surprise. And I think that's something that reflects very well on him. And then to pick up quickly on one of Michael's points, I knew I was not around in 1994 here, but I knew he had run as a different candidate against Ted Kennedy. But I didn't realize until I really dug into that just how different a political profile he had back then. I mean, it's the candidate running for Senate in 94 is virtually unrecognizable, you know, when we watch Mitt Romney today.
Well, and that's so interesting to talk about the transformation of his politics from the early 90s to today. And that goes back, guys, to his father, George Romney, a popular Michigan governor who ran briefly for the Republican presidential nomination and then served unhappily for a time in the Nixon administration. And, you know, Michael, the politics that Mitt Romney had back in the 90s seemed to me to be very much the politics of George Romney. Today, we'd call George Romney a very liberal Republican.
Well, that's exactly right. Mitt Romney has said that he idolized his father and he's just a shadow of the man he called the real deal. And his father was really, you know, by today's standards, a liberal within the Republican Party. He walked out on the 1964 Republican Party nomination of Barry Goldwater because of George Romney was more liberal over civil rights, for example. And Mitt Romney really did sort of run in his father's mold when he was trying to defeat Ted Kennedy in 94. So today's Romney is a lot more conservative, but also the party that he's trying to win the nomination of is a lot more conservative. So I think that's the reason that people, you know, see some awkwardness there is because he really is, you know, has to go further and further to his right, obviously, to win the nomination.
And, you know, Michael, it almost sounds cliche to say, you know, Mitt worshipped his dad, but he did. Talk a little bit more, if you could, Michael, about how George Romney shaped Mitt. At one point in the book, you call George, I'm quoting, the author of his life's ambitions. Wow.
Yeah, it is amazing when you look at the trajectories of their lives. Both men, you know, obviously deeply immersed in their Mormon faith, both, you know, made a lot of money in business, and then both became governors of a state, and then both sought the Republican presidential nomination. You know, it doesn't get more clear than that. Clearly, his father failed in 1968. You know, a lot of people remember or have read about the fact that his father made this comment that he'd been, quote, brainwashed, unquote, by the generals in Vietnam, and that sentence is attributed to his not being able to win the nomination. There was so much controversy over that. You know, his father campaigned in Nashua, running for the Republican nomination in 1968, but dropped out before the primary was actually held because he just was going nowhere after previously having been leading in the polls. So his son has seen his father's failure right there in New Hampshire and has really, you know, I think from all my interviews and so forth and reading, that he's been really trying to pick up where his father failed, you know, all these years later.
And yet, Scott, there's a shaping to, you know, so much admiration for his father. But also, correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, from the portrait I get in the book, you know, George Romney's kind of blustery and he calls it like he sees it and doesn't care if he makes somebody mad. Mitt Romney's a lot more cautious.
That's right. That's one of the fascinating sort of contradictions here is you've got this son who is really modeling his life after his father in many ways. And yet politically and stylistically, they are very, very different. And, I mean, Mitt Romney is far more scripted and cautious and careful and disciplined than his father was. I mean, they're very, very, very different. And, I mean, it's unimaginable to think about Mitt Romney doing some of the things that George Romney did in terms of, you know, Michael mentioned storming out of the 1964 convention. I mean, can anyone picture Mitt Romney storming out of a party convention over something like that? I mean, I certainly can't. So that's one of the things we wanted to explore was even as the father shaped the son, the son really has cut his own path in other ways.
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, the co-authors of a fascinating new book called The Real Romney. Join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also join us on Facebook. And the co-authors, Michael Cranish and Scott Hellman, both work for the Boston Globe, and they will be speaking at St. Anselm College tonight at 6 o'clock. If you want more information about that particular event, go to our website, nhpr.org. You know, gentlemen, the thread of George Romney is pulled throughout this book. Another thread that I want to talk to both of you about is Mitt Romney's deep Mormon faith and continuing questions about it. Your book goes way back, Michael, going, you know, way before Mitt Romney was even born, those early Romney pioneers out on the frontier, trying to find a safe place to settle. Just remind us, Michael, how those first Mormons were treated in America.
Well, it's a great question. I was really fascinated by this part of the story, and it does go back a number of years. Romney's ancestors were an integral part of the founding of Mormonism in this country. Mormons were persecuted. Mitt's great-great-grandfather came over from England after hearing Mormon missionaries there, came over here, brought his family here, and went to Nauvoo, Illinois, which was then the center of Mormon life in this country. All the Mormons were pushed out of there, and so the Romneys were part of this great, you know, Mormon trek to the west to what became the state of Utah, and they settled there. And then Mitt's great-grandfather, Miles Park Romney, who's a figure in this particular chapter, he takes multiple wives, as he's told to do, and then when polygamy is banned in the United States, Mitt's great-grandfather was told to go to Mexico and found a colony where polygamy would be allowed to continue and flourish. And so that's what he did. This great-grandfather had four wives that he was married to while he was there. And it's not an ancient story. Mitt's father, George, was born in this colony. And then when there was a revolution in Mexico, George Romney, at 5 years old, was part of the group of Romneys who then fled Mexico, came to this country, and then built a new life for himself. And so you really have to understand that story. And the Romney history is one of flight, persecution, rebuilding, determination, certainly of all those leading up to Mitt Romney. So that, I think, is just part of understanding the makeup and the character. And frankly, it's a rollicking tale. It's a sort of a Westward Ho, you know, tale. Has so many extraordinary elements because there's letters, diaries of all of Mitt's ancestors that I was able to get access to. So, you know, it's an interesting story, but it also is a very telling story, we think.
Yeah, it was interesting to me. It's not just that Mitt Romney is a devout Mormon, but that his family was really part of the founding of the Mormon faith here in this country. Great stories. I mean, you know, at one point, Miles P., who's this huge figure that you talk about, who had to flee to Mexico, he had to hide out in a wagon, right, Michael? Because, you know, they were coming for him with shotguns.
They were coming for him, and the incident you talk about occurred when they were living in Arizona. They went from place to place. They were told, settle a mission here, settle a mission there. And Mormons were not well accepted in a lot of communities, and then they had to flee. And in particular, because Mitt's great-grandfather was a well-known polygamist, and this was not taken kindly to by a lot of non-Mormons where they settled. And so then he did eventually have to flee. They came for him with a shotgun, and they hit him out. And then he did go to Mexico, as I mentioned. So even if Romney wasn't running for president, frankly, I think this is just a really interesting story of American history, not just Mormon history, really understanding a key portion of our history when the West was settled. It's sort of a Wild West, you know, part of the story, you know, but a really interesting one.
Well,
and it's instructive, Laura, because, I mean, as Michael said, you can, if you sort of follow this course forward, I mean, clearly Mitt Romney grew up in a very different way than even his father did, right? I mean, he grew up
right.
in a comfortable home in suburban Detroit, much more of a kind of normalized, typical, you know, kind of baby boomer existence. But, you know, Romney at one point told a fellow church member that the Romneys were built to swim upstream. And you can get a sense of, I think, that ancestry to some extent when you watch him in politics, because he's incredibly persistent. He's, you know, he's not easily, he's not someone who's just going to bow out when times get tough. And I think he's got that in his blood a little bit. And you know, it's one of the reasons why he is sort of stuck with it and stuck with it and stuck with it. And he might end up with this nomination after all.
Well, I've got a couple more questions about the religion factor, and then we will move into Romney's later political career, talk about some of these early influences. But right now we're going to take a very short break and check in with our March membership drive.
I'm Sherry LaPierre. I live in Dublin, New Hampshire, and I am a sustaining member of NHPR. The Exchange has impacted me a lot, especially during Senate and congressional races, governor races, because when the candidates are invited on, they have a full hour of Q&A, of stating their views, stating their policies. It's in an environment where it's relatively calm. It's one candidate. He's got the floor, or she's got the floor, and I'm always confident in the questions that Laura Kanoy brings up or challenges them with, and I find that very, very beneficial. Being able to call in and talk to, ask Charlie Bass something directly or challenge him directly and give him a chance to state his case or any other candidate for that matter is really, really valuable. In trying to make a decision on, you know, who you're going to vote for. You don't get that anywhere else.
It's there every day. But this is sort of a nice chance here during this March fund drive to remember just how unique and how special the Exchange is with Laura Kanoy. I'm Brady Carlson. Good morning. I'm here with Rick Ganley during NHPR's March fund drive. It's been a great morning so far. And why don't you join us now and make it even that much better at 1-888 805-6477 or at nhpr.org.
It has been a great morning so far, Brady. You know, we've heard from several new members today, and that's fantastic because when we hear from 75 new members by 7 tonight, we're going to get an additional $2,000 from Bill and Kathy Gillett of Manchester and Mary Gross of Concord. They have put that money on the table saying, look, it's time for new members of NHPR to come on in and make their voices heard. You can do that right now with a phone call to NHPR on our New Member Challenge Day, 1-888-805-6477. That's 1-888-805-6477, or go to nhpr.org.
And do it for The Exchange, a program that's going to give you thoughtful, in-depth conversations about the issues that matter. And we're hearing one example of that today. Two Boston Globe reporters who know Mitt Romney about as well as any journalists do. They've written a book about him, and we're talking about the book. Of course, Mitt Romney, over the years, he was on The Exchange talking with Laura Kanoy, as many presidential candidates have over the years. And those are two examples of great conversations. I'm just thinking of the shows this week, though. We heard that really thoughtful discussion earlier this week about the proposed moratorium on new refugees coming to Manchester, New Hampshire. And what a great show that was. You listen to The Exchange because you expect that kind of thoughtful dialogue that's going to really make you think and help you learn something about the issue that's being discussed. Well, you can help support it right now when you make a gift at nhpr.org or at 1-888-805-6477.
And you think about it, Brady, you think about how much you spend in the course of a month, you know, maybe $10 to pick up the Sunday newspapers, maybe $8 or $10 in a Netflix subscription, or just, you know, one ticket to a movie in a month. It's not a lot of money, $10 in the context of your monthly expenses, but surely NHPR has a greater value than some of the other things that you do spend that $10 on. So if you become a sustaining member at that level, we'll charge your credit card the $10 a month, and you'll be a member in good standing until you tell us to stop. And right now is a great time to do it during our new member challenge.
This is the best time to do it, I would say, in fact, Rick. And we're looking to hear from 75 new members by 7 o'clock. We've already heard from 8 new members, and that is a really good start. But there's $2,000 additional dollars on the table from those generous donors, Marty Gross of Concord, Bill and Kathy Gillett of Manchester. They are encouraging you to do your part today. If you've never made a gift to New Hampshire Public Radio, you're going to be surprised at how easy it is, how affordable it is, how quick it is, and how good it feels when you join this community of thousands of people who believe in public radio and want to keep it strong in New Hampshire. So pick up that phone right now. Call 1-888-805-6477. Visit our website, nhpr.org, to pledge online. And thank you so much.
Additional support for NHPR comes from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children every day, online at nhsaa.org. And from Hearing Solutions New England, where audiologists diagnose hearing loss and dispense hearing aids, in Nashua, Manchester, Concord, and online at hearingsolutionsne.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the co-authors of a new book called The Real Romney join us. They are Michael Cranish, Deputy Chief of the Washington Bureau of the Boston Globe, and Scott Hellman, staff writer at the Boston Globe, who covered Mitt Romney's years as governor and some of his political campaigns. We invite your questions or comments about this at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page, join the conversation there. And Scott and Michael, just before the break, we were talking about Mitt Romney's strong Mormon faith, the background that his family had as a prominent Mormon family, a real, as you said, Michael, a rough and scrabble story. How did Scott Mitt Romney talk about that story of frontier grit later in his political life? What does he say about it? And just as important, what doesn't he say?
Well, I think it's more significant what he doesn't say about it. I mean, in my impression, you know, he talks about it very, very sparingly, if at all. I mean, we recount in the book that in his prior home in Belmont, he did have portraits of some of these Romney ancestors up in his hallway. And, you know, I think to some extent, clearly, he's proud of where he came from and recognizes certainly the sacrifices that his ancestors made, including his father, to get him to where he was. But I mean, as a political matter, it's virtually non-existent from his stump speeches, from his appearances, from his TV ads. And you can understand why. I mean, not only is Mormonism itself viewed still with skepticism in some parts of the American electorate, but, you know, you go back a little ways into his family, and the reason that they're fleeing these different places is largely because of polygamy, which, of course, is not a winning political issue, I think, in modern times. So, you know, it's clearly right there under the surface, but, I mean, he talks about that history, you know, if at all, I mean, very sparingly.
Well, and one more question about this. Yeah, Michael, and the question is for you. He gave a speech, Mitt Romney, in 2008 about his faith, a speech that was widely praised in many corners for really just addressing this head on. Remind us what he said, Michael, and did that put some of the concerns among the evangelical community about Mitt Romney's Mormonism to rest?
Right. Well, in the last campaign, he really made an overt effort to reach out to evangelical leaders, had them to his home in Belmont, Massachusetts, and he gave this speech that you referred to at the George H.W. Bush Presidential Library in Texas, where he basically said, you know, my Mormon faith is private. In this country, we have a great allegiance to religious liberty, and I'm not going to take orders. Basically doing something similar to what John F. Kennedy did in 1960 and talking about his Catholic
talk in
Texas as well. And he did not try to use that speech at all to explain Mormonism or to, you know, and so forth. That was not his effort. He did not want to do that. This was the one, you know, speech that he's given fully on this topic, and he hoped that settled the matter. And in this campaign, he hasn't delivered a similar such speech, and he has not sort of made the same overt appeal. He's basically, you know, tells people who ask about it, look at the Constitution, you know, Article 6, that there's no religious test, quote-unquote, for political office, and hopes that the matter ends there. He was able to do much better in Iowa, you know, nearly winning the caucuses there this time around, but he obviously has faced some problems, particularly in southern states, because of this. And just to follow up on your question earlier, in the campaign, it's interesting, he doesn't go into great detail about his ancestry. Let me give you a couple of things that he does do. Last week or 2 weeks ago, he referred to, quote, his, quote, unusual religion, but he did not mention the word Mormonism. And he said that in the context of how he has met as a church leader in Massachusetts with many people who are less well-off than he is, and he tried to use that in a sort of unique attempt to connect with people. It's not something he's done much before, but you could see he was trying to find some way to talk about it without being highly specific. The one instance I'm familiar with where he does talk about his background is that he has talked a little bit about his father, George, as I alluded to earlier, was born in Mexico, which a lot of people didn't realize, and then came to this country. He didn't say that. You know, he says, you know, his father obviously was not Hispanic, but he has said that, and particularly, you know, I know he said it in New Hampshire. He also said it a lot in Florida, where there is a large Hispanic community, just to sort of try to make a little bit of a connection there. So he's talked about it in that context. But even when he wrote an autobiographical book and talked about his great-grandfather going to Mexico, he did not explain why his great-grandfather went to Mexico, which was to protect polygamy within Mormonism. He just said that his father, great-grandfather, excuse me, went to Mexico. So he does not go into the details, even though clearly if you talk to most other Romneys, you know, this is something that's a big deal. And I had the chance to go to Mexico, visit the colony, and visit with some of Romney's cousins who still live there. And these people have never met Mitt Romney. He's never visited that colony. But you go there and you meet these people and you can see there's a very strong connection.
You know, you said as we talk to other Romneys, and that's a really interesting question I wanted to ask both of you. Scott, you first. So in doing this book, what kind of access did you guys have to Romney confidants, Romney family members, Mitt Romney himself?
Right. So there's a complicated answer. In short, I mean, Mitt Romney himself in the campaign and his close family decided that they did not want to cooperate with the book. So they did not sit down with us specifically for this project.
And why was that, Scott?
Well, their rationale was that there are lots of campaign books out there, and if we agree to this, then we have to agree to others. You know, we tried to say that, look, this is going to be a hopefully high-profile biography and really the only one out there of him, so it would behoove you to sit down with us. But you know, I think they felt like they weren't going to get anything out of it. And, you know, some of his family basically said, look, you know, he's got a pretty good chance of winning this thing, and why would we screw it up?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that said, because this is built on so many years of our work at the Globe and others' work at the Globe, we had access to you know, a whole trove of material, including interview transcripts with Romney, notably from 4 years ago when we did our first big biographical series on him. So we had all this unpublished material to work with. And certainly, and even this time, even in doing the book, there were many close friends of us, of his and the families who agreed to talk with us. So I think even though he didn't sit down with us for the book, I think if you read it, you see that his voice and the voice of his family and people around him are pretty well represented.
Yeah, I was struck by that, and I was wondering how many people actually said, yes, you know, we will sit down and talk with you guys. Anybody, Michael, who you wished you really could have talked to, besides Mitt Romney himself, obviously, that would have helped you with this book? Flesh it out even further.
The only other person besides Mitt Romney, to be perfectly honest, is, you know, George Romney's no longer living.
Right.
I sure wish I could have had the chance to talk with him. And Lenore Romney, Mitt's mother. I mean, we did, you know, talk to, I mean, I wrote a chapter, for example, on the 2008 campaign and why that failed. And I talked to really everybody that I wanted to talk to. And it's a sort of behind the scenes story of what happened there, including, you know, a good bit of material about New Hampshire. And, you know, a lot of people agreed to talk to me and did talk to me on the record. The book is mostly on the record. There's some things that are anonymous, but by and large, it's on the record and, you know, very fully footnoted and so forth, because we really want to be full and fair. Even the campaign aides who didn't want to be quoted in the book, most of them we talked to. A few, you know, along with Romney said, you know, we're not, you know, allowed to talk to you. But, you know, as Scott alluded to, some of our Globe colleagues over the years have done interviews. A lot of that material has been unpublished, so we could tap those resources. So we're indebted to those colleagues who did those interviews and passed them along and saved them, you know, frankly, over the years. So, you know, we really had a unique, you know, it's like writing a history of someone, even if they're no longer living. You can go back and hopefully look at letters and things like that. And we're able to do all sorts of things to hopefully put together a pretty complete story.
Our phone number here in the exchange again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address, exchange@nhpr.org. Well, gentlemen, we would be remiss if we didn't spend some time talking about Mitt Romney's time in the private sector. That's a big part of his career, really shaped his time as a politician. And you guys write about how Romney came to operate in what is called the Bain Way at Bain Capital. Scott, what is that, and why, despite Mitt Romney's tendency to be risk-averse, the Bain Way was in many ways perfectly suited to his personality?
Sure. Well, what they set out to really do in first in setting up this consulting firm and then later this venture, this private equity firm, was to really go into a company and pull it apart down, you know, basically it's like stripping down an engine to its parts. You figure out every different component, what it does, what's working, what's not, what the markets look like, what they can do better. Originally, you know, in the consulting phase of it, they would consult for a company for a fee, and then they realized, well, hey, wait a minute, if we're here, you know, trying to make companies better, why don't we step in and reap some of the benefits? So then they started to actually take ownership stakes in them and so forth. And I can let Michael fill out more of the details, but it's very much suited to his personality in terms of taking a ton of data and boiling it down and then making a decision based on what you learn.
Well, and working with his dad at the auto company, again, what's making these cars work? What isn't? How can we make them better? It's very much analogous, Michael, right? I mean, kind of simple, but still.
Yeah, you know, his father was in a very different situation. His father came into American Motors Corporation, you know, which was having all sorts of problems, and running that company really did turn it around. One of the great success stories in Detroit. Mitt was a very different type of business person. One of the things you asked what surprised us, one of the things that I sort of knew, but, you know, the more I researched it, the more it surprised me. Mitt Romney himself has written that he didn't actually run the investments. That was left to run the companies. He was running a big investment fund. That fund, in turn, invested in companies. But Mitt Romney did not go in and take over a company and run it himself.
And say, you're hired, you're fired.
So on the campaign trail, what's that?
And say, you're hired, you're fired. He wasn't making those decisions.
But not so directly. And maybe that's one of the reasons he made that comment, so that he could remove himself when people, you know, were fired, remove himself from that decision-making process. But it is a complicated story, and what we really tried to do, I work with another reporter at the Globe on this chapter, Beth Healy, what we're able to do is look at the 15-year career at Bain Capital. So on the campaign trail, it all gets boiled down typically to 30-second sound bites. Romney says it was fantastic. Opponents say he was a vulture capitalist. We look at the 15 years. There were about 100 investments that Romney was involved with during that time. Some were very successful. Some were not successful at all. And we really try to give a fuller story of what actually happened at Bain Capital. So, you know, just to give you a quick example, he talks, you know, more than anything else about Staples.
Right.
Staples was an investment of about $2 million, and that returned about $13 million. That's a fine return by any measure, but it's a very, very, very small deal in the context of how Bain Capital made its money during Mitt Romney's tenure. To give you a different example, there's another deal that he does not talk about on the campaign trail, in which Bain Capital invested $50 million in an Italian company, and that ended up returning more than $1 billion. That's the kind of deal that made Mitt Romney very, very, very wealthy. Obviously, jobs were not created in the United States in this particular investment, and one of Romney's partners who was involved with that told me it was like getting hit by the lucky stick. It was basically an investment in a Yellow Pages-type company that became an Internet play and that boomed in the Internet boom, and they did extraordinarily well. So that those two examples give you a sense, I hope, that we've tried to take a fuller look at what actually happened at Bain Capital, what his role was, and how they actually made most of their money.
Well, and about 2-3 months ago on the campaign trail, when there were more candidates, Michael, there was all this, you know, he's a vulture capitalist rhetoric going on. And yet, you guys write that this has come up before, right, from Mitt Romney? I mean, this is an old critique.
This is something that was absolutely, you could almost run the campaign ads from 1994, and here's some of the same arguments.
His U.S. Senate race against Ted Kennedy.
Exactly, against Ted Kennedy. They talked there about a deal called AMPAD, which was a company that jobs were lost and union members came to Massachusetts and, you know, complained that Romney, in effect, you know, had caused them to lose their jobs. So it's not something new, but it's something that, you know, if you don't really know the full story, and obviously people living in Massachusetts and New Hampshire may be more familiar with that. But, you know, after that Senate race, he came back to Bain Capital, and that's where he actually made most of his money. So prior to the Senate race, this AMPAD deal had gone on, some other deals had gone on. He lost the Senate race, and then there were many, many, many more deals that people probably are not, you know, as familiar with that we also write about. So it's something that's dogged him for a long time. He basically was in this business that he calls creative destruction, and, you know, that he says that's a very necessary part of capitalism. And a lot of people certainly would agree with that. But there are times when certainly companies are shut down, jobs are lost. We looked at this claim that, you know, more than 100,000 jobs were created by Romney, and we conclude that you simply cannot definitively say that. Romney does not provide hard and faced data for that, and the Bain Capital says it's correct, but they don't provide all the backup. And it turns out most of those jobs come from the Staples investment I referred to earlier, and a lot of those jobs were created at Staples after Bain pulled his investment out. Now, the Staples founder told us, well, look, you know, without Bain's initial support, we probably couldn't have gotten off the ground, so you can give him credit for every job ever created at Staples. But it's a little more complicated than the story you may hear in a soundbite on the campaign trail.
All right. And, gentlemen, after a very short break, Scott, I'm going to turn to you for some of Mitt Romney's time as Massachusetts governor. We will be right back.
My name is Ruth Smith, and I live in Canterbury, New Hampshire. We love the exchange. Laura Kanoi is just fabulous. She has a way of really bringing out questions and making the guests answer to her questions, which are probably questions we'd like to be asking. And if they're not, we get to call in and ask our own questions and make our own statements. I've called in many times, and it's always it feels like it's, you know, it's a really local program, and that's one of the things we love about NHPR as well, is that it's not just national news, it's really the local things that matter here in New Hampshire.
We know that's why you listen as well. Welcome to the March Fun Drive. I'm Rick Ganley, host of Morning Edition here on NHPR, alongside our All Things Considered host, Brady Carlson, and we are welcoming you to the March Fun Drive and asking you to help us shorten the drive by giving now, 1-888- 805-6477. And we are asking specifically new members, to give us a call today. We want to hear from 75 new members by 7 o'clock tonight. And when we do, Brady, we've got an additional $2,000 on the table.
That's right. And so it makes sense for you, if you've never given before, to make a gift right now at 1-888-805-6477 or at nhpr.org. Radio is, at its most basic level, a conversation between people. That sounds easy to do, right? But actually, it turns out to have a really compelling conversation is a little trickier. That's why Laura Kanoi is so great, because she makes it sound easy. She makes it sound like this is just the easiest thing in the world to ask these questions and have this great conversation to get these guests to talk about issues of the day. But there's so much that goes into that, thinking through what the next best question is going to be to keep that conversation strong so that the end of the conversation is just as interesting and compelling as the first minute. That's what Laura does so well. She's doing it right now, again, with the authors of the book, The Real Romney. You should support her with a call at 1-888-805-6477.
Yeah, the great ones, Brady, always make it look so easy, don't they?
Amazing.
But they've done their homework and they know what they're doing. That's why you listen to Laura. That's why you listen to NHPR. You know, if you have an EasyPass transponder, it's probably hooked up to your credit card. I certainly have one, and it makes life a lot easier. And when your balance gets low, EasyPass automatically makes a charge to replenish your account. Well, you can set up something like that right here at NHPR. So when you become a sustaining member, you set up a monthly charge to your credit card for as long as you like, and it could be as small as, a donation like $5 or $10 per month, and then it all goes to pay for the news, and you don't have to think about it. The next time one of these pledge drives come up, you don't have to worry about it. You say, I'm all set. I'm a sustaining member. It's easy to do. Very quick and easy. 1-888-805-6477. Become a sustaining member. It's a great way to support your favorite radio station. 1-888-805-6477.
Exchange fans, if you're enjoying today's conversation as much as I do, we have a special thank you gift that's only available for a little while longer. You can get a copy of the book that Laura is talking about with her guest today, the book called The Real Romney. We have just a limited number of copies available for people pledging at the $120 level or higher, and this is something you can get on the phone, so you have to call to pick up a copy of the book. But if you want your own copy of The Real Romney and support NHPR at the same time, call 1-888-805-6477 right now with your $120 contribution.
You know, you think about the exchange, it's the only statewide call-in program in New Hampshire. It's the only statewide forum on the radio here. Laura and the team bring in guests to discuss New Hampshire concerns and answer your questions, and they talk about concerns here in New Hampshire that have national implications, like the conversation we're having today about Mitt Romney. Support that programming. Support that programming that you've come to rely on day after day with a phone call now. 1-888-805-6477. New members, let's hear from you as well. This is a new member challenge. 1-888-805-6477. You've been listening to the show for a long time. Now's the time to show your support at nhpr.org. And thanks.
Additional support for NHPR comes from Lilly's Design Resale in Concord, across from Marshall's, offering Gucci, Louis Vuitton, Chanel, bridal and vintage. Consignor program details online at lilliesdr.com. And from Ansel & Anderson, trust in estate attorneys helping families transfer wealth from one generation to the next. On the web at Ansel & Anderson in Bedford. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today we're talking with the co-authors of a new book called The Real Romney by Michael Cranish and Scott Hellman, both with the Boston Globe. It gives a wide-ranging and yet also in-depth portrait of the man who's become a household name. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Michael and Scott will be at St. Anselm College tonight at 6 o'clock. For more information, go to our website, nhpr.org. So, gentlemen, picking up the threads that we've talked about George Romney, Mitt Romney's father, and his huge influence. We've talked about his faith. We've talked about his time at Bain Capital and the critique of that. Mitt Romney goes back into the private sector after he loses the U.S. Senate race. He's thrust back into the public spotlight when he's asked to rescue the Salt Lake City Olympics in 2002. And then Scott Hellman, he starts thinking about public office again. And it's Anne, right, that really gets that conversation going? How did that happen, where he thought, okay, I've been out for a while since I, you know, licked my wounds from 94. I think I'm ready to get back in. Tell us about that transition.
Well, I think one of the things you have to remember about Mitt Romney is that he has always had his eye on, of course, entering public life in some way. We talked earlier about his father. This was, of course, the example his father had set: be successful in business, make your money, and then give back. I think Mitt Romney always had this in mind, even before, I mean, obviously he ran for Senate in 1994, but when he took over the Olympics, he was doing that knowing that a successful Olympics, a successful turnaround would set him up very nicely to reenter or to try to reenter public life as a candidate. And so there was this fascinating moment in 02 as the games were going off about what Mitt Romney would do. There were some suggestions that he would stay in Utah and run out there. But then it was perceived that Massachusetts would be a better launching pad for some kind of national campaign, that it was a higher profile state connected to Washington, of course, on the East Coast. And so Mitt and Ann, after, I mean, remember, there was a Republican, Jane Swift, who was the incumbent, who was running for re-election.
Right.
And Mitt had said, oh, I'm not going to challenge her. And then it became clear that Jane Swift was in trouble politically, and Mitt Romney knew that this was his opening. And then in a matter of days, you know, the Olympics go off successfully. They're back. They fly back to this, you know, incredible welcome by a lot of Republicans in Massachusetts saying, you know, my God, we really need someone to step in this race and keep the governorship in Republican hands. And he was the natural candidate. And, you know, he always has this thing where he likes to say, oh, I didn't want to do it, or I had to be talked into it. And I mean, that might be partly true, but I think it's also become kind of his shtick that I think from earlier on than he would admit publicly, he was looking at this as an opportunity. And look, he was a great business guy. He knew how to go, you know, he knew when there was a market there, and this was his market, and he seized it.
That's the Bain way again, right? You're looking at the problem, you're pulling out the pieces, and you're saying this is the possible solution.
Exactly. I mean, they'd done polling, quietly done polling, trying to figure out how he would match up. They looked at the other candidates. They looked at Jane Swift's numbers. They gathered all the data, and this was the good opportunity.
Well, and Scott, to you again, since you really covered Mitt Romney's time as governor, it's in his later years as governor where we really see Mitt Romney change. He becomes far more conservative than he's been in years past. What changes do we see, and whenabouts do we see these changes?
Right. So he wins office in 2002, more or less as the same candidate that he ran as in 1994, somebody who was fiscally conservative, but socially liberal or moderate, not terribly ideological.
Just like George Romney.
Yeah, in many ways like George, and more to the point like Bill Weld or some of the former Republican leaders in Massachusetts who had done very well with this kind of, you know, balanced philosophy, if you will. But very early on into his term, Mitt Romney is looking elsewhere. I mean, it was literally 6 months into his term as governor that he and his aides began setting up his political action committee to begin to run for president.
So 6 months into office.
6 months into office.
Wow.
So I think this was very clearly part of the grand plan for a long time. So then you see a couple of years in, beyond just the sort of mechanical preparation for running for office, he really begins to change politically. He starts describing himself as firmly pro-life. He becomes one of the most outspoken opponents of gay marriage. He changes his mind on the environment. He's starting to sound more conservative on guns. I mean, really, immigration. I mean, up and down the line, he starts to sound like a very different candidate. And, you know, politically at the time, we have to remember, as you remember, Laura, that Rudy Giuliani and John McCain were the big names in that Republican field 4 years ago, and they were very much in the center or center right. And there was nobody of that stature in the right wing of the party. And Mitt Romney and his advisors set out to position him as that guy, even when some of the state level people were saying no, this isn't going to work. They went for it, and of course in the end it came up short, and it seemed like not a natural fit for him. But that was really when he shifted to the right. And you know, this campaign he has not run away from that per se, but he has de-emphasized those issues again in a big way and decided to focus on the economy, which is much more in his wheelhouse.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, Scott, because you're right. 4 years ago, he was sort of the conservative alternative. Today, he's almost considered the moderate alternative.
Right. He's the Massachusetts moderate, in the words of, you know, Gingrich and Santorum. And, you know, there's some truth to that, certainly, when you look at his record historically. And I think part of the reasons they made that adjustment is that it clearly didn't work last time, that he did not convince enough people that he was genuinely the social crusading social conservative. And so this time it's, you know, economy, economy, economy. And he better hope, if he's the nominee, that that stays the number one issue in voters' mind.
Well, and I'm wondering, Michael, if you have any sense or if you remember from, you know, all the reams of interviews that you've gone through, what does Mitt Romney himself say about this, these position changes, and where his heart really is today?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You can go back and pull out a quote, you know, that says something like, I just didn't do a good job of getting my message across. And that sort of quote comes almost after every campaign he's run. He will look back on a campaign that was unsuccessful. Obviously, he did win the governorship, so he was successful there. But when he lost for the U.S. Senate, lost in 2008, that was his conclusion. Oftentimes, politicians will say that, you know, if people only really understood my message, I should have done a better job of getting that across. But part of it is, you know, frankly, because, you know, he has changed his ideological views over the years. So people have had this question about what are his core convictions. If he once was for abortion rights and now is against abortion rights, you know, where does he stand really? So that's one of the reasons that, you know, in a Republican primary, he's had, you know, quite some difficulty. He is trying to run on the economy, but as these primaries have dragged on, he has had to appeal strongly back to what he really didn't want to do, which was to basically go as, you know, very far to the right, which is, as I mentioned at the beginning, he called himself recently, quote, severely conservative, which is an odd construction of words. But he was trying to appeal, you know, again, and he still needs that. You know, it's not over. We don't know that he'll have enough, even if he does very well, if he'll have all the delegates needed by the time they get to the convention in Tampa to be the clear nominee. Likely he will be, but, you know, it's not over yet, and the next round of primaries are not necessarily favorable to him. So, you know, he's still got, you know, some of those problems connecting with the conservative base of the party.
Well, and to both of you, Michael, you first, you know, there's so much in this book that we've talked about and that we haven't covered, chapters on, you know, the health care law that Scott wrote, talking about the Salt Lake City Olympics, fascinating story. But just real broadly, Michael, if you could, what do you hope people who read this book take away from it?
Well, I really do hope that, number one, they find it to be, you know, readable, thorough, you know, factual, fair, unflinching. That's what we set out to do. We don't have an agenda. We don't tell you, you know, who you should vote for. At the end of the book, we really look at it as a biography where, you know, you really can understand the full life story and hopefully be comfortable that, you know, the reporters and editors who worked on this book at the Boston Globe, and it's not just us, you know, really, really did try to give you a fuller sense of the man, because the problem with the day-to-day campaign is that snippets and sound bites and the context sometimes is lacking. And we really try to be the complement to the daily coverage that we also think is very important.
What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, and I think there's so much about what we see of Mitt Romney in the present that can be explained by the past. I mean, isn't that true for all of us, of course? But
right.
There are so many people who I think are judging him only in the present and have questions about him, and it's why I think people find him enigmatic or hard to pin down or distant. And I think, yeah, like Marco said, our attempt was to really give you the full picture, not just going back to his birth, of course, but many years before that, to figure out, you know, what the Romney stock is and, you know, how that blood has shaped him and how his ancestors have and certainly his father, and bring you up to the present. And then hopefully with all that information, voters and the American electorate and everybody else can, and even world leaders, you know, can get a better sense of who this guy is. I mean, he still might be the next president of the United States.
Well, gentlemen, have a great time at St. Anselm College tonight. And I'm sorry I won't be there, but I know you'll get a great audience. And thank you so much for joining me this morning. I really appreciate it. Scott Hellman, thank you a lot.
Thank you, Laura. Great to be here.
That's Scott Hellman, staff writer at the Boston Globe. And Michael Cranish, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you, Laura. Really enjoyed it.
That's Michael Cranish, deputy chief of the Washington Bureau of the Boston Globe. Again, they're co-authors of the new book, The Real Romney. Let's check in now real quick with our March membership drive.
And this is NHPR's March Fund Drive, where you can help support the exchange and what you hear every day on NHPR by making a gift at 1-888 805-6477 or at nhpr.org. I'm Brady Carlson here with Rick Ganley. We're taking just a few moments before the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock to remind you that in public radio, members make the difference, especially members who have never become members before, because we have this new member challenge in front of us, looking to hear from 75 first-time givers during the day. And when that happens, NHPR gets an additional $2,000 to go to work to pay for programs. 11 new members already so far. Let's make that 12 with your call right now.
At 1-888-805-6477. Or you can go online to nhpr.org as well and become a member of New Hampshire Public Radio. And Brady, this is a perfect time to do it with that challenge on the table. And, you know, after listening to the exchange today, you realize that New Hampshire, you know, it may be geographically a small state, but you realize as a resident of New Hampshire how much impact we have. Of course, we just had our primary, you know, with nationwide coverage. Our coverage here at NHPR was carried nationwide because of that. But, you know, there's a lot going on here in the state right now with the State House. Between January and June this year, of course, the State House being in session, we help you keep track of the legislation. It isn't easy, but NHPR is here to do that. We have reporters at the State House. Josh Rogers always updating you on what's happening with certain bills. That's why you make time for shows like The Exchange in our newsroom, because we keep you abreast of what's going on here at our own State House, what's going on nationally on the political scene. And, you know, that's the kind of programming that you expect day in and day out. It's not cheap to produce, but we know it's important. It's part of our mission. It's why you listen. And you can support it right now when you become a member of NHPR. 1-888-805-6477. That's 1-888-805-6477.
Your participation in NHPR is absolutely essential. That's why we do membership drives like we're doing today. It's actually the most efficient way to reach out and find you. I was trying to think of an alternative, Rick, that would work as well. And the only thing I came close to finding was that anytime I saw somebody driving around with an NHPR bumper sticker on their car, or if I heard that they were tuned in to Morning Edition or The Exchange on the car, I would sort of drive around until I could, you know, could get them to roll down the window and then try and talk them into becoming a member. I thought that would probably be too creepy. So this, I think, is a little more effective and not creepy. Just give us a call at 1-888-805-6477. We're reaching out to you. Let's hear from you.
And if you see a guy driving up right next to you because you have an NHPR sticker, he's waving at you. It's just Brady.
Just say hi, Brady.
He's just being friendly. Don't worry about it. Now, if you just enjoyed The Exchange, you just listened to this conversation we had about Mitt Romney, and you'd like a copy of the book we've been talking about, The Real Romney, by those two Boston Globe reporters who have been following Romney for years, we have 10 copies available, and one of them could be yours if you would like to pledge at the $120 level right now. Give us a call. You can